BBC World Service and NRK. This is Death in Ice Valley. I'm Mari Tigraf.
And I'm Neil McCarthy. And this is episode 3. The Remote Archive.
Okay, Neil, we have a few more facts at our fingertips.
That's right, we have a name and a nationality from her hotel registration form, which is quite exciting. She's one Fenella Lorck from Belgium. What struck me is how vivid our witnesses' memories are of their very brief encounters with the Istal woman in hotels or shops.
Well, you have to remember, Norway was a very different country back then. Foreigners really stood out. Iver Neumann is the director of Norwegian Social Research, and he can tell us more about that.
In Norway, immigration only started in the very late 60s. That meant that everything that happened out of the ordinary was easier to spot than today. So, yes, diplomats stood out in Norwegian society. People simply knew that they were foreigners. That wouldn't happen today when 29% of Oslo's population is either foreign-born or born of two foreign-born parents. And a lone woman traveling around like that must have had business. I mean, you're not a teacher if you travel like that. You may be a spy, you may be a prostitute, you may be a traveling saleswoman, but there aren't that many other possibilities.
This became a big criminal case in Norway very quickly. Police were analysing everything, trying to make sense of the odd clues, like the wig and the code note they found in her suitcase. And of course, they were checking out the information on the hotel registration form.
And presumably, they'd be cross-checking that info with the Belgian police.
Yes, but it takes a little time before they get answers. I think we should first go back to the city of Bergen and pick up the trail. We know that she spent time there. We know that she left for Bergen the day she bought the boots. The reason for us knowing that is from the documents of the police reports, you know. Gunnar Stålesen, Bergen's famous crime writer, is waiting for us at the quayside.
But this is part of the modern time coming to Bergen, because what is typical for Bergen around 1970 is that the baby boomers, children who were born just after the Second World War, they were going into the universities, so there was a big student revolution going on. She would most likely could have seen a demonstration against the war in Vietnam, against atom bombs, and against the European Union, because there was a big discussion, should Norway be a member of the Union or not?
So it was a real time of change and tumult and generational tension.
Yeah, and the young people started to grow long hair. The girls had shorter skirts, they had hot pants for a period. And the music was part of this town's culture. We had some very good rock groups. So it was, for young people, a very lively town.
So it's potentially quite an interesting time to be in Bergen for Fenella Lorck in the last days of her life. But let's get back to the investigation in those first days after the body was found.
Yes, the police were just about to make a breakthrough. They took her hotel card, studied the handwriting and searched in all the hotels of Bergen and in other big cities in Norway to see where else did Fenella Lorck stay. Do you remember what the receptionist said at the hotel in Stavanger?
Very distinctive handwriting. And what were they able to find out?
That she hadn't stayed anywhere else. There were no records of a Fenella Lorck in any other hotels in Norway. The Norwegian police also checked the information on the hotel card with the police in Belgium. And they couldn't find any trace of Fenella Lorck and reported back that her passport number was false.
Okay, well, that's more than a bit suspicious.
What they did find was her exact same handwriting on many other hotel registration cards up and down Norway and especially in Bergen. But, hold on, with 7 different names. She had been traveling under at least 7 different identities.
7 different names. She has to be a spy, right? I mean, this is starting to sound like something from the movies.
Well, it looks that way, but we're not in Moscow or Washington. Why here in Norway? We'd better take a closer look at what could have attracted a spy to Norway in 1970.
Well, the period is called the Cold War because it was an almost war between the Soviet Union on the one hand and the US on the other, and they both had their allies. And one of the US allies was, of course, Norway. It was a founder member of NATO. NATO was the security organization that kept the US and Europe together. The whole thing was about the East and the West feeling one another out. In 1968, liberal communists in Czechoslovakia wanted to do something else than the Soviet model, and the Soviet Union answered by going in and occupying the place. And that increased tensions. Ships were, sort of Soviet ships were sighted off the Norwegian coast, for example. So 1970 is only 2 years after that. So we're in the depth of the Cold War.
So how did that affect a city like Bergen at the time?
The biggest naval base in Norway had moved to Bergen in the early 60s. So what we saw in the streets of Bergen too were a lot of marine soldiers going out on leave for evening. And in the sea outside Bergen, there was regularly big NATO exercises when warships from USA, from Germany, from England were in the harbour, very often in the weekends when they had a rest in the rehearsal. And during all the 60s and 70s, there were a lot of sightings of submarines in the fjords in the western part of Norway, which most likely were Russian submarines, or to see if there was some marine installations used. Because, of course, in the 1960s and 70s, the Cold War was more or less on its strongest. It was quite a big fear of a war against the Soviet Union.
Soviet submarines snooping around the fjords whilst NATO conducts military exercises. Sounds like Bergen would have been a magnet for spies, with so much secret military intelligence in the air at the time. Spies like Finella Lorch and her aliases?
Could be, but we don't know that she was a spy. And if she was, then who was she spying for? What was she spying on? Where was she really from? And what real evidence is there?
No matter which world she was moving in, the reality is she died on that bleak hillside in the most suspicious circumstances. Now, often in these cases, the body itself contains clues. And I'm just thinking back. You told me that the body of the Isdal woman was taken to the Gardas Institute at the University Hospital in Bergen for the autopsy. What happened there?
We should go there and ask. Professor Inge Moril is the chief forensic pathologist at the hospital. I'll introduce you to him. One of his predecessors did the original autopsy. And tell us, how did they conclude concerning death cause?
It was to conclude that the fire was very important, obviously, because she had carbon monoxide poisoning. So they concluded that that was probably the reason, the cause of death. But then they got the results from the toxicology, which revealed that she had, in addition to carbon monoxide, a lot of drugs in her blood, which is a barbiturate. So both the concentration of carbon monoxide and the concentration of barbiturate could be the cause of death. Mm-hmm. It's an open verdict. And it is not concluded whether it was a suicide or an accident or a homicide.
This is significant because I'd assumed up until now that she died of burns or of smoke inhalation and that was it. But now these pills are detailed in the autopsy.
It was, in fact, also the most common type of pill used by women who took their lives with an overdose, at least at that time.
A common form of suicide, and yet a very strange place to do it, a strange way to do it.
Why make all that effort and go into that, all the way into that desolate valley and put herself on fire and all these arrangements with the things she brought in that valley. So it would have been easier to do that just lying in your hotel bed, taking the pills.
Anyone who's ever watched a crime drama nowadays will know that many identification cases are solved using DNA evidence. But the body was buried here in Bergen, as we know. And the body holds the evidence inside that zinc coffin.
Yes, that's right. Her grave is here in a Bergen cemetery. But it's very complicated for all kinds of ethical, legal and practical reasons to exhume the body to take samples like tissue and bone for analysis. It would be a massive breakthrough in our attempt to identify her if we're able to find any of her remains, then extract our unique genetic code, DNA, and match it, if we find a relative.
It sounds like without that hard scientific evidence, it's going to be very difficult to find out who she was.
Just find the right key. There is a lot of things in here.
I contacted Inge Morell when I began this investigation to see whether there was any physical trace of the Isdal woman in the hospital archives.
As you can see, they are numbered into years.
Listen carefully now. This is a recording in Norwegian of our original search.
It is Vevsblokken.
So, here are the tissue blocks. And if we take that block there, and then we look here at the number on the report, we'll find the one that matches. It may be that's the Isdal woman. Yes. Inside these paraffin blocks is preserved tissue from the Isdal woman, from her internal organs. And when there is tissue, there are cells, and from there you can extract a DNA profile, which can lead to identification or the possibility of identification. But here are the fingerprints. Here are photos of the teeth and some X-rays. Before the body was buried, they actually took out the jaws and teeth and kept them in case she could be identified at a later date. We've got a key here to the remote archive where old things are stored that haven't been thrown away. We could search for the teeth of the Isdal woman. I'm skeptical about us finding anything, I must say, but we should try.
What was it like to be there, Marit?
Oh, it was so exciting. I mean, just to find, to see these tissue samples from this dead woman, almost 50 years old samples, it was so exciting. And then knowing we are going to search for the jaw, hoping to find it.
We are långt under selve sykehuset I det som heter...
We're now far below the hospital itself, in what is called the pathologist's remote archive. This, actually, that's the jaw from an unidentified person. It's not what we're looking for. There are several jaws here, but... They're all the remains from unidentified persons. That's why they aren't destroyed, just waiting for a time when they can offer new information. Here. I see something marked 1970. Here it says 134/70. That's her number. Now, this really is exciting.
Shall we write my hand?
My hands are shaking as I open it. Incredible.
That
this is the jaw of the Isdal woman. It is completely unbelievable. See, there are even some good teeth in place. See the fillings in the lower jaw teeth. We also see the gold there. Yeah, so there's no doubt. This is the same jaw as on the picture. The same teeth, eh? And here is her number.
This is probably mouse.
We'll take these with us. Dagensfangst.
Catch of the day.
Catch of the day.
That truly is a big catch. Tissue samples and the jawbone full of gold teeth.
It was an incredible and unexpected find. It's high value in terms of DNA. We need to take this new physical evidence to scientific specialists, and we'll also need the cooperation of the police and their laboratories. Let's see what it can tell us today about her identity that it couldn't in 1970.
An identity she was very good at covering up with her many different names. So perhaps the science could reveal who she really was. But it's hard not to think that the Isdal woman was on a secret mission when she was here in Norway.
Yes, I agree on that. But what kind of mission? The producer of Death in Ice Valley is Neil McCarthy.